A65. Syllabus 5. Number 1A.
Well, we have this week our last syllabus class, syllabus 5. And I must say at once, when I say the last syllabus class, that this is not my last appearing in America, because that's usually the next conclusion, that if I say this is the last syllabus class, that one feels I may no more be coming back to America. It's just that our syllabus program, as far as I can see it, comes to an end. And in this syllabus program, we have considered really the fundamentals of Christian Science. And we all know that those fundamentals are really those three big categories of being. First, that category of the seven synonymous terms, which covered syllabus class 1, 2, and 3. And then we did take last year the second category of being, namely the four sides of the Holy City, Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science. We did take that on the level of Christian Science, that was syllabus class 4. And now this year we take the third category, the levels of science. So the main accent in the whole week will be on the levels. And therefore train ourselves to be able to think in levels, and no more just on one level of consciousness, but in a multi-dimensional sense. Naturally, when we have covered these three main categories, there are many other fundamental subjects that we could take as a syllabus course. We could take a class on the matrices, a class on text interpretation, and things like that. But I don't want to go on, because I feel that what we have done up to now is plenty, that perhaps not everything has been digested properly, that there is a reason that we take deep breath, so to say, and perhaps afterwards consolidate more what these fundamentals have presented. It's actually quite clear that if we are master in the tonality of these three categories, that then we have learned, so to say, those fundamentals that enable us afterwards to use those fundamentals in an infinite way. Like if we would study in music, first the fundamentals of music, and then when we are master of them, we can start out to be interested in the ramification of these fundamentals and listen to the symphony. And the same thing is true in this subject. I feel when we are really master and have the tonality of the seven and the four and the four levels, if that has become our own true nature, that we begin to think in these categories, that we are even beginning to feel in these categories, that then really we can hear the symphony which is presented in the Bible, which is presented in the textbook as a whole. So what we have been doing actually is only training ourselves in the fundamentals so that we should be enabled to read the Bible and the textbook in a more intelligent way, in a more scientific way, in a more spiritual way, so that the textbook becomes much more definite and defined to consciousness, that we can see within those pages of the Bible and the textbook the whole system constantly being brought forth, constantly being elaborated, embellished, and shown in its infinite variety. So this would be the purpose of the syllabus class. And therefore, I feel that with the end of this week, we have reached some kind of a saturation point where I feel I shouldn't go further and push further, that what we have been doing these 5 years could afterwards be again digested, and then perhaps what I intend to do over the next few years then shown in its symphonic sense through the Bible and the textbook. One big point that is most important, I think, at this point. It was always important, but I feel at this point it is super important, is to realize to oneself, each one for himself, how much he has got the letter of the system of Christian Science and how much he has got the spirit of Christian Science. Actually, that is true right from the beginning. A student always should evaluate, do I talk about the letter or do I have the spirit of that letter? Do I feel the spirit of that letter? Do I hear the spirit of that letter? And at this point, this is super important so that we feel that we have not just got the letter, which is important, of the subject, but that we ask ourselves more and more how much have we imbibed the spirit of it, how much do we feel the whole system, how much do we feel the flexibility of that system, the infinite adaptability, the infinite restructuring of that system, so that we are not tied to terms and to words and to the letter, but that we can really spiritually hear and feel and see what this system really wants to be to us and for us. So we have made, so to say, our finger exercises, and now it will be a question, well, after this week, when we have done the third category, a question of really seeing that we get the spirit of it in a more in a deeper and deeper sense. And there is a big point that I would like to bring out today. I felt you have been traveling today and a bit tired, and I don't want to squeeze you like a lemon with questions. I like just to talk a little bit about the general atmosphere for this week and for the work we are doing. And I would like really to talk a little bit about this letter sense and the spirit sense, but not as we have done in an earlier class where we just have considered what Mrs. Eddy says about the letter, what she has said about the spirit of the thing, and about the wedding of the letter and the spirit. But I would like to take it into a rather bigger framework, in a framework that Mr. Dolly has once pointed out in an overall way, and which I have also made a short resume in my book on the four levels of spiritual consciousness. You know that the assignment for this week was to go over most part of that level book, really starting around about page 63, where the level book starts by bringing out the four different levels of consciousness. And that was the assignment. But right before that, on page 59 to 62 in that level book, in those few pages I have presented something that has great implications for what we are doing spiritually now. And listening around over many years since I have written that book, I have always felt that practically nobody has taken notice of those few pages. And in a way, it's a pity. So I go and back to those pages and try to show them again, and perhaps be able to
put it into our present-day life experience. In those few pages, I have given a survey of how in the thousand-year periods of the Bible, in those six, and starting with the 7,000-year period, in those thousand-year periods, really that great question has been presented, how the letter can be wedded to the spirit, in quite a unique way, I would say. Namely, to show somehow that spiritual teaching should always be through symbols. That's a great difficulty we have. We have a subject that is purely spiritual. Now, how can we teach spiritual values except actually through spirit alone and not through material means, through language, through writings and so on? Because the moment we use language and writings, we use symbols and not the facts. So if one is not on the level where spirit communicates with spirit, and all of us are not yet on that level, then really there is the ladder that is brought down on earth to show that there are ways and means how really we can follow a certain line that leads us step by step nearer and nearer to the point where spirit can understand spirit and where spirit teaches to spirit. Up to that point, it is necessary to have symbols. So Mrs. Eddy says spiritual teaching must always be taught through symbols. And that is the great difficulty which then we encounter. The moment we teach through symbols, very soon the symbols become much more important than the spiritual idea behind the symbols. Very soon we forget even that the symbols are not the reality itself, and think that if we talk about the symbols and can talk about the symbols, that we talk spiritual values, and we don't. We only use symbols but not the reality. That's the reason why it is possible that somebody can talk about Christian Science very intelligently and very fluently and doesn't need to have the faintest sense of the spiritual reality behind those symbols. And that always is the great danger. So the question that we have to ask ourselves as we have been studying the letter of these three great categories of being, that we are aware, especially for ourselves, not so much for the other one, we can leave the other one alone, that's his problem, but for ourselves, to ask ourselves, how much have I really imbibed the spirit of it? And those 7,000-year periods give a quite interesting measurement, a standard, a measuring rod, so to say, according to which we can measure a little bit how much we really still think that symbols are important and have forgotten the reality, the spiritual reality behind it. So in those three pages I go through those thousand-year periods, not in order to show in the first place that they symbolize mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. We will do that next week when we do Genesis. But only in regard to this enormous big question, what is the relationship between symbol and the idea itself, the reality itself? And where do we stand in our own consciousness? And I think I can point out that most of us are still in the second or third thousand-year period, and perhaps a little bit going over to the 4,000-year period, but that we are not at the end of the 6,000 and 7,000-year period. So let me try to show that slowly and as simply as I can. The first 1,000-year period. You know, that first 1,000-year period covers really that period of the record of creation, the second record of creation, then all what comes after that second record of creation, all about, and he begat so-and-so, and he begat and begat and begat and begat. It was all the creative sense that was super important, that was in the forefront of people's mind, namely, what is the origin of man? From where do we come from? What is our origin? What is our creator? The answer for us is naturally mind, the divine mind. But here, in regard to the question of symbolism and true idea, see, it is that period where each one of us still is, where we are very much concerned about the question, who or what is our creator? That goes through all history of mankind, through the individual man, that he always asks himself, where do I come? What is my origin? And therefore tries to figure out what is the origin. And at this, in this first 1,000-year period, you can see that it was symbolized through the Adam story, was symbolized through genealogy. He begets so-and-so, and that one begets so-and-so, and that one begets so-and-so, bringing out the genealogy of Cain, the genealogy of Abel, the genealogy of Seth. It's all about where do we come from. And that's the same question that we may ask today, where do I come from? And if we are interested in that question, we can see that we are way back in mistaking a creation myth as the idea. So at that time, the creation myth was the symbol, trying to symbolize the idea of mind, the idea of creator. And therefore, we were interested in the symbol, and not so much in the idea, because they were investigating the genealogy. And that is what happened so often with us. I am a teacher, or I am a pupil of so-and-so. That's the genealogy again. Instead of seeing I am a pupil of the divine mind, from where I get everything, we say, I have been taught by so-and-so. And if that so-and-so has been a big shot somehow in the movement, you are a better pupil. You have been instructed better. See, this is all that wrong concept of believing that there is reality in a creative personality, in creative man, in the Adam man, in the teacher man, in the parents as men. That's all that stuff. And we are sidetracked by thinking if we have a better origin than somebody else, we are better, and we aren't at all. Only that which we have received from the divine mind is our reality. In the second 1,000-year period, that whole question of symbol and idea, the relationship of symbol and idea, changed. Suddenly, with the Noah story, and with the ark and the flood and so on, the whole idea actually changed, where they were not asking so much, who were my parents, from where do I come, what is my origin. Now suddenly they talked something of the nature of reality through legends and sagas and such kind. Can you see that they began to see and to think there is a reality in a legend, that there is a reality in the sagas, that there is reality in gossip?
because most of the legends and sagas have certainly no reality. They are made up. They are made up things. And therefore, again, we can see that we have to be aware that we do not believe in the reality of stories, of what is being said, what is being handed down, what is being broadcast from one to the other. All that talking that goes on, it has no reality within itself. But after a while one thinks there is reality in it. We wouldn't be interested in all the talking that goes on and all the gossip that goes on if we wouldn't feel that there is reality in it. If we would see right through it, say, well, there is no reality in anything that mortal mind thinks out, that mortal mind presents. There is no reality in it. We wouldn't be interested in it, not a bit. We would turn away right away. We would make that second day firmament and would just put it away and say, well, this is old stuff. I remember how Chandoli used to say when somebody complained that so-and-so had said something bad about so-and-so, he said, well, if they haven't talked about God, they haven't said a thing. Now think how life would be different for each one of us if we would have that attitude. If all that is being told us that is not told by God, from the Word of God, would see that they are legends, sagas, that they have no reality, that only that has reality which is spoken by God. Can you see how life would be different? Can you see how we fall in the trap of believing there is some kind of truth or reality in the sagas and in the legends, and we try to find a solution for that, but naturally there is no solution because they have never been real, they can't be made real. So we have that same problem, that we are deep down really in constantly hearing about things and listening to things and being pressed by things and feel they constitute reality. Then came a great break, and suddenly in the 3,000-year period, you know, that 3,000-year period starting really with Abraham, it was all suddenly tribal history. We come now to a 1,000-year period of tribal history, of what Mrs. Eddy calls half-hidden Jewish history. How much do we believe in our history, in the history of our family, in the history of our life, in the history of our country, in the history of mankind, in the history of the Western civilization and so on. It's all half-hidden history of a tribal history. We have there Abraham, we have Jacob, we have Sarah, and afterwards the next generation against the tribal history of Isaac, Esau, Jacob, Rebekah, and another generation of tribal history, Jacob and his 12 sons, and the tribal history of Joseph, then the tribal history and the history of the children of Israel, beginning with Moses, then with Moses wandering through the desert and through the wilderness and coming into the promised land. That ends, so to say, the tribal history. Now can you see there is a whole period where really we can see that tribal history has been taken for the idea. They believe that what Abraham has seen and said is a divine idea. Think about the present political situation we have in the Near East today with state of Israel. It's all built on this false sense that the tribal history is the idea of God, because they say to Abraham it was promised that this land belongs for eternity to the children of Israel. And so because they take that as reality and not as symbol, they have the whole problem there. And that is only one example that can be multiplied by billions of times, that we think that the tribal history, our family history, our business history, our national history is an actual history, that it is something that is being impelled by God, that God has said so and so, and we take it for the idea. We misunderstand again the symbol for the idea. That's where all the trouble comes from.